Welcome back to the City Journal California podcast. I'm Ben Boychuk, associate editor of City Journal. And joining me is Stephen Malanga. He is senior editor of the magazine. He has a very important piece in the spring issue. It's called The Green Behind California's Greens, how a handful of super rich donors have created the illusion of a grassroots environmental movement. Steve, it's a very interesting piece, very important. I don't think many readers will know about a lot of what you bring to light in the story. But I'd like to start by just talking a little bit about a short history of how the environmental movement, the radical environmental movement that we see in the Golden State today, sort of emerged out of the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, well, you know, California has often been associated with environmentalism, and some of that goes back actually to the 19th century. And, and a lot of that was efforts really to kind of preserve the state's great natural beauty. Obviously, John Muir is a key figure in this, helping to establish Yosemite and Ansel Adams, the photographer. But much of environmentalism, it wasn't even called environmentalism in California before the 60s and the 70s, was really about conservation. And then also dealing with the problems of pollution that came about in many places around America because of smog created by leaded gasoline, but particularly in California. What happened, though, really, is that starting in the 70s and in the 80s, we started to see a kind of a new environmentalism, sometimes called deep ecology, which really basically saw humans as, imposing themselves on the environment, and started to kind of what started to kind of merge was an anti-growth environmentalism. And Jerry Brown, actually, in his first iteration as governor, took to a little bit of this. He was particularly a proponent of a book called Small is Beautiful by a European economist, which basically suggested ramping down human economic development. And this was in contrast to his own father, Governor Pat Brown, who had really kind of helped to build the infrastructure of the state as a background to making the state a great place for new development and for economic progress. So as this started to emerge, essentially what happened is at the same time we saw the growth of a great wealth in California, particularly in, of course, technology in Silicon Valley. And much of that wealth is now really behind the environmental movement in California. And it is really staggering wealth when you think about it.
Right. So let's get into that a bit, because really the bulk of the article is about just the vast sums of money that is swirling around the contemporary green movement. And it comes from some sources that I think a lot of people will have heard of, but it also comes from maybe some unlikely sources. You talk, for example, in the story about Hewlett-Packard, and in particular how the foundations that the Hewlett and the Packard foundations began as one thing and then turned into something else. And you also refer to people I think everybody knows. You talk about Eric Schmidt, one of the founders of Google. You talk about some other really key technological players. And how did that, though, how did this really anti-growth, often bizarre kind of counterproductive sort of green focus come out of these guys who really, are interested in innovation and making the world in some ways a better place through technology? How did that happen?
Well, Dave Packard and William Euler were really founders, core founders of the notion of Silicon Valley, going all the way back to when they founded their company before World War II. They themselves were, incredibly inventive, but politically, they were not what you would think. Dave Packard, for instance, was the Undersecretary of Defense under Richard Nixon. He contributed to conservative and moderate free market causes. Euler himself was interested in scientific innovation. He contributed a bit to conservation, the form of environmentalism that was about, for instance, preserving the Sierras and things like that. What really happened with them, and this we've seen this in the charity world, in the nonprofit world in general, with other institutions, the Ford Foundation comes to mind, is the heirs, when these two fellows passed on, they left staggering sums of money in their foundations. I believe it's like $8 billion in the Hewlett Foundation and something like $5.5 or $6 billion in the Packard Foundation. And their heirs essentially took the both of those foundations into environmentalism to an extreme degree, both in terms of political giving to environmentalism. And then in this really crucial moment back in 2007, they decided, based on the study that they had commissioned, that they were going to become major funders and create a small group that would essentially pour in hundreds of millions of dollars into the issue of climate change in California and then around the rest of the country. And so far, I mentioned that I think Euler has given $500 million into this cause in a specific new foundation that's been created, and the Packard has given another $390 million. So those are pretty big sums on their own, and it's really their heirs who are doing this, not the original founders, who have long since passed on.
Let's talk about Tom Steyer. His name, I think, a lot of Californians would know. Maybe not so much outside of California, but maybe so. He's been a major player. As you point out, he's really he's probably the most visible face among the super rich environmentalist funding cabal. talk about him a bit, because he's really kind of been the man behind a number of pretty transformative ballot initiatives, certainly, that have come along over the past decade or so.
Yeah, the thing about Steyer is, he's probably, if you follow politics, the most well-known and the least surprising on this list. And he actually probably has the smallest amount. I mean, some of the sums here, I talk about some of the other folks like Gordon Moore, from one of the co-founders of Intel, who are talking about a foundation with $5 billion in it. Steyer has a lot of money. He doesn't actually have that kind of money. But here's the thing. He's been willing to put his money into political change, and he gained a lot of notoriety when he essentially put together a PAC to put $100 million into political races around the country, supporting candidates that supported climate change legislation. What he's also done, I think, which is much less well known, except if you are in California, is that he sponsored a number of initiatives out there. California, of course, has the initiative and referendum process where voters can directly vote on a lot of things. And environmentalists have put big money into quite a number of initiatives. And Steyer himself has done that, including one in which he sought successfully. He ran an initiative that he backed with about $5 million of his own money to essentially raise taxes on out-of-state firms that operate in California, and put that money into things like development of alternate sources of energy. And so there have been a number of other initiatives in California where essentially the environmentalists have backed these direct voter battles over things like raising taxes and putting the money, raising taxes on certain, forms of energy, or redirecting money into kind of environmental initiatives. The initiative and referendum process in California can be very, very expensive. And there have been some environmentally oriented initiatives out there that have basically spent, where tens of millions of dollars have been spent just on advertising and organizing and so forth. So that's something that's a real feature of California. And if you get a lot of money, you can really influence the vote in that manner.
You lead the piece with a sort of a brief account of Proposition 23, which was a 2010 initiative that would have suspended what Californians know as AB 32, It's the actual name of the law is the California Global Warming Solutions Act of 2006. Of course, we're since on to climate change, not global warming. But you talk about that campaign. I mean, that campaign came along. I had written a story for City Journal in 2009 that noted that something like that initiative was on its way. It came at a time when California's unemployment rate was up around 12.4%, I think. And a lot of people were saying, you know, this global warming law that we have is really putting a damper on the recovery. The law allows the governor to suspend the law for at least a year in case of economic emergency. This sure looks like an economic emergency. Governor Schwarzenegger wasn't willing to do it, so this ballot initiative came about in 2010. What happened then?
Well, you had this group, several groups that sponsored the initiative, including some blue-collar unions that were in favor of it, small businesses, some manufacturing groups, and energy companies, too. But what happened is the environmental movement responded with a $30 million campaign against it. And even though the sponsors of this initiative thought they had a compelling case with unemployment in double digits, California's unemployment at the time was among the highest in the nation, they thought they had a compelling case. As the Los Angeles Times put it, they were steamrolled by this $30 million campaign by the environmentalists. And one of the this coalition, this environmental coalition, it consisted basically of everyone from hedge fund guys, technology billionaires, Hollywood entertainers. It was described by one of the people in the movement as the new face of the environmental movement. But as I say in the piece, it wasn't the face of the movement, but the checkbook of the movement, which was very impressive. And so with that money, they managed to defeat Proposition 23. Interestingly enough, several years later, a coalition of minority Democratic legislators in California also sent a letter to the governor and the legislature saying, essentially, we need to do the same thing, that we're not recovering in our communities, and we need to suspend the law. They were essentially ignored, but they were making the same argument. I think this was in 2000, actually it was last year, 2014. So that argument continues to be one that's relevant in both in poorer communities and also in a lot of the blue-collar communities like in the Inland Empire and Central Valley, where the recovery hasn't spread, the recovery that we're seeing on the coast in California. But it hasn't really, they haven't made much progress in this effort to suspend the, as you said, the global warming law.
Here, I think, is sort of the key passage in your story. The California environmental movement's primary work isn't grassroots organizing and proselytizing, however. It's the lobbying, campaigning, and legal advocacy of behemoths like the Sierra Club, the Environmental Defense Fund, and Earth Justice, which is a $40 million public interest law firm that calls itself the Earth's Lawyer. And then you say in the next sentence, these giants derive much of their considerable funding from the super rich donors that we're talking about. Talk a bit about, because you then go on to say that really some of the great triumphs, I mean, we've talked a little bit about some of the ballot initiatives, but you say some of the great triumphs in California on behalf of the green movement haven't come through initiatives, haven't come through legislation, but have come through court rulings. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, this is a crucial point. First of all, because there is so much environmental money in California, that is money from foundations, it has attracted, if you will, a lot of the big groups. It's not only, if you will, you take something like Earth Justice, which is California-based, although they do file lawsuits around the country. It has not only nourished California institutions like Earth Justice, but it has attracted other environmental groups from New York or from Washington, D.C. to California because there's money there to run operations, if you will, in California. So it's kind of an imposing group out there. And one of the things that the environmental movement has discovered is something that other liberal advocacy groups in other areas had discovered, and that is using the courts to file suits, and particularly to get activist courts to essentially do for you what you can't get done through the legislature, or you can't, you know, you can't get people to vote on. And so Earth Justice, for instance, files a lot of lawsuits in New York, in California, and they it includes things like, they litigated, for instance, to stop the Port of Long Beach from exporting coal through its facilities. It's not California coal, it's coal from around the country that what's happening, there's great demand for this in places like China and India, and the stuff comes from around the country and it's being exported through California ports, and they sued to try to stop this. They also have sued the state's utilities repeatedly to force them to spend more money on renewable resources infrastructures. We're talking about solar, of course, and wind. Even though this is a money-losing proposition, they're using the courts to push them to do this. And of course, probably the most famous or infamous of all these suits is the lawsuit about the Delta smelt, the fish that essentially they've sued under the Environmental Protection Act in order to stop transfers of water throughout California, something that Victor Davis Hanson has argued in City Journal has exacerbated the California drought. They've sued to stop this in order to essentially preserve this small fish, which is threatened. And that's been a very successful suit. It's a quite a complex scenario out there, but the environmentalists are succeeding in the middle of what is a very deep drought in California, in which some of the water that is available in the northern part of the state is not actually making its way to customers who need it, because we're trying to protect this fish.
You know, there's a lot more to discuss in this story, and I hope people who are listening to this will seek out this article in the spring issue of City Journal. But I kind of wanted to wrap up with this. You note near the end of the piece that the California environmental movement has gone so far to the left that not even Jerry Brown is good enough anymore.
Yeah, so the Sierra Club and the California League of Conservation Voters declined to endorse anyone in the governor's race last year because Jerry Brown won't come out definitively against fracking. Now, nobody's really fracking in California anyway, because it's so complex that it's simply not, you know, going on. But unlike in New York, where Andrew Cuomo has definitively banned it, Jerry Brown refused to do that and is actually kind of hemmed and hawed and said that, you know, with the right amount of regulation, this might not be such a bad thing. And so they declined to endorse him, even though in most states he would be considered, I think, pretty much an environmentalist by other standards.
So really, what do we want readers and listeners to really understand? I mean, is it the case that all of this environmental activism is limited to making California sort of a basket case economically? Or is all this money that's sloshing around with these, you know, these multi-million dollar donors and these foundations and nonprofit organizations and public interest law firms doing their work, do they pose threats to the rest of the country as well?
Well, they certainly have enough money that they are already funding these kinds of campaigns in other places where available. I talk about a couple of these. A number of these California groups, for instance, have given heavily to a movement in Canada, basically to stop Canada from essentially pumping all the oil in the Alberta tar pits up there. which is a vast source of energy. They also were behind a ballot initiative in Michigan to enact a version of the global warming law in California in Michigan. It was a ballot initiative. Of the $4 million that was spent by a group that was sponsoring this, which was called, I think, the Michigan Energy Group or something like that, something like $3.3 million of it came from California, actually. So, and they've also supported anti-fracking campaigns in Colorado and an effort to get Nebraska residents in Nebraska to oppose the Keystone Pipeline. So there's enough money out there, certainly, that they can afford to contribute to campaigns elsewhere, and they're doing that now.
Well, as I say, it's an important and indeed in-depth piece. I think readers will want to delve into it. And I mean, there's a lot that we didn't cover. We're really only giving people a taste of what is in The Green Behind California's Greens by Steve Malanga, which is in the again in the spring issue of City Journal. Steve, thanks again for talking to me.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. If you're hearing this, you're almost certainly hearing it at City Journal's website, www.city-journal.org. You can also find us on Facebook, facebook.com/city-journal. For City Journal, I'm Ben Boychuk. Thanks for listening. Be well. Take it home.